The American novelist and essayist Leslie Jameson is our guest now on her new memoir, Splinters, Another Kind of Love Story, which excavates three tumultuous years, new motherhood, a marriage breakdown, and navigating life as a solo parent of a young baby living in a sublet next to a fire station in New York, returning to teaching writing, and book tours for a recently published bestseller. In that earlier work, The Recovering, Leslie Jameson reflected on her own alcoholism and recovery and the history of substance abuse in America. She's described it as a hymn to, quote, sobriety and sharpened attention and showing up, staying present, end quote. She's also author of The Empathy Exams, which touches on her eating disorder as a young woman and examines empathy between people. Leslie Jameson directs the graduate nonfiction program at Columbia University. She'll be in Auckland next month for the Auckland Writers Festival. The details are on our website. And she's with us, I think, from New York. Hello, Leslie. Thanks for your time.
Hello. I am joining you from New York. It's wonderful to be talking to you.
Fantastic. Let's get stuck into the new book, Splinters. It's a reference that would resonate with so many people trying to hold lives together, reconstruct lives after separation. Could you take listeners back to the opening scene, to being alone with your daughter in a sublet? Where were things at when you began telling your story?
Yeah, so the story begins with me and my daughter showing up at our new home with garbage bags full of diapers, teething crackers, little Christmas lights to make our new dark apartment glow a little bit, to give it a little bit of light. The book really begins with this moment of trying to start over again once the life that I thought we would be living, the script that I thought we were following, wasn't the life that was going to happen. So how do you build a different kind of family than the family you imagined? How do you build a different kind of life than the life you imagined? Those are really the questions that drive the book from the very beginning.
You'd been separated from your writer husband. You had separated. I think you'd been in therapy for about 3 years. And in part, what we do through the book as a reader is go back and, I guess, deconstruct what happened in that relationship over time. But this is also very much about the power, the potency of that connection between mother and child, that overwhelm, but also the sheer power of that connection, Leslie.
Yeah, I you're really putting your finger on the pulse of the book, because I thought the reason that I wanted to write this book was not necessarily because I wanted to, you know, dredge my life right out into the public eye, but because I wanted to find language for that particular life experience of feeling such different things so acutely at the same time. So I was feeling, at this particular season of my life, I was feeling such grief for the end of my marriage and such intense, almost intoxicating love for my daughter. And that was what I wanted to write about. I wanted to write about, how does life hold grief and love at once? How does life hold kind of letting go of the death of one love and also living into this very consuming, different kind of love between mother and child?
The detail that you commit yourself to as a writer is there from page one. You touched on it already, you know, pondering why diapers, or nappies as we call them here, have a breakfast pattern on them. The fireman carrying a box of Cheerios and a chainsaw, the Cheerios being the same breakfast as your baby's. This power of detail is what, Leslie? Why is it so central to your writing?
I so believe that every story kind of comes alive in its particulars. And I so believe that every life is sort of made by its particular details, and that the more specific you get about a story, the more it can actually resonate with people who, even if they haven't shared the particular life experiences that you're describing in the story, they bring their own, the more that you build a world for them on the page, the more that they The more that they can bring their own life experiences and kind of resonate with what's there.
So it is both relatability to any parent who knows that sleeplessness, who knows that sheer terror of having a baby who's sick, very young as yours was, and people trying to work out what was happening. There's one amazing scene where you describe having a really bad flu and you're literally prostrate on the floor looking at your baby. And it's that question of, you know, when is it okay to ask for help? Either you relate to it because you've been there, or you can be in it even if you haven't been there, right?
You know, I mean, that's the hope, right? The hope is that when you tell a story, that story can matter to people, not only because they share the particular experiences that you're describing, but because that's how art works. Like, it's how literature works. It's how storytelling works, that that the story can mean things to people in ways that you can't even imagine. And, you know, I think some of, you know, I always write into questions. Like, I always write into questions about, you know, what does it feel like to be alive? What does intimacy feel like? You know, how can a life hold grief and love at the same time? And I think sometimes questions are a way to sort of bridge one life and another life. So maybe somebody reads my book and they've never been married, they've never been divorced, they've never had a kid, they've never lived next door to a firehouse full of firemen with their chainsaws and their Cheerios, but maybe they've lived their own version of grief and intoxicating love at the same time. Maybe they've lived their own version of, my life went off the rails and I started to live, you know, I had to build a new life kind of from the ashes of the life that I'd been living before. So maybe their questions are the same, even if their experiences are very different.
Writing about the end of a relationship has its own particular challenges because there's someone else involved. And if you're both writers, and goodness knows how many of these memoirs have been written in their own way, if you're both writers, there's this decision about where the line gets drawn, isn't there? About how to convey honestly, but also how to convey respectfully. How did you approach that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I have a couple of answers. One, it has to do with actually the form and the structure of this particular book. So the book is called Splinters, in part because it's about, you know, certain experiences, memories, relationships that sort of got under my skin and stayed there, right? Like the way that, you know, when a love dies, it leaves a little part of itself behind, right? And I wanted to honor those sort of painful splinters that lodge in us and become part of us. But Splinters is also about the form of the book. It's told in these very short, crystallized, as you said, very textured, detailed, particular shards of prose, these almost like little powerful vignettes. And what those vignettes allowed me to do is tell exactly the parts of the story that I wanted to tell and hopefully give a reader a very kind of comprehensive, encompassing, intimate experience, but also, you know, to tell the parts of the story that I wanted to tell and to leave the rest out and to sort of figure out what's necessary for the art and what's necessary to stay in life. So there was a way that the structure of the book allowed me to say the things that felt emotionally important for the work of art I was creating, but leave plenty of things sort of in life, leaves plenty of things in privacy. And the big thing that I thought about, especially in writing the end of my marriage, was, you know, to not have a book that had villains and victims, both because life, my life, I think most lives don't have black and white villains and victims, good guys and bad guys. You know, we're all complicated, flawed human beings. And so I wanted to write myself as a complicated, flawed, culpable, guilty, struggling human being. And I wanted to write my ex-husband as, you know, yes, a flawed person, but also somebody deeply capable of love and devotion and humor. And so I really tried the best that I could to bring his humanity to the page in very complex ways as well.
It seems to me a book that could only have been written anyway, ready for publication after time. Because you are at a point where, yes, you can talk about how you experienced anger, but you can, or from him, but you can also write about understanding his pain and the things that caused you to become isolated from each other. That wouldn't have been possible, I imagine, necessarily in the sublet, apart from all the time and energy that was going on. Does that take some time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It takes time. And I think that, you know, part of the project of making art from life, you know, which is like a huge project, it lives across all the disciplines. You know, there are writers who make art from life, there are performers who make art from life, there are writers who make art from life. And I think for me, it involves sort of doing certain things in the moment. Like sometimes I'll take a lot of notes so that I can remember, you know, those nappies in the garbage bag, so that I can remember, you know, those firemen and their chainsaws. I think that texture is part of what can make a world feel real on the page. And some of that needs to happen kind of in the moment. I write down those details so that 5 years later, 10 years later, I don't lose them. But there are certain kinds of emotional perspective that I think do take a little bit of time. And it's usually less that somehow what I was feeling in the moment was wrong and that I come to doubt it or turn on it 5 years later, but more that what I was feeling in the moment wasn't the whole story, right? It was just one layer of the story. And maybe, you know, 5 years later, I can feel like I can see both the anger I felt so strongly and fiercely in the moment, but I can also feel all these other things around it. I can feel maybe the ways that anger was just a way I was shielding myself from grief. I can see the ways that anger was a way that I was shielding myself to protect myself from somebody else's pain. You know, so it's less that kind of time or perspective makes alive what you felt in the moment, and more often, at least to me, that it allows you to see that what you felt in the moment was just like one piece in a much larger jigsaw puzzle.
And there are lots of fragments, as you say, that give us a hint that where you don't entirely gloss over some of what came your way from him. We just get a hint. We don't need the whole story. We just get a hint of the dynamics. And you can also be equally ruthless on yourself in a way, honest with yourself. And one of the really potent parts about the early book was when your little girl was sick and there was worry about it being, I think, hypothyroidism, which would have needed immediate intervention and have carried risk, and it turned out not to be. It turned out to be something much less worrying. Sorry, it's a little bit of a spoiler, but I'm going to go there, forgive me. And in that moment, it's to your mother who was there helping you that you first turned, and that was noticed by and hurt by your husband. He registered that. Why wasn't it me first? But it takes, again, a good deal of honesty to recognise what had happened in that moment and your part in it, or the impact of your action, Leslie.
Well, yeah, I mean, thank you. And I think that's one of the things that good first person narration can do, not to say that mine is always good, but that this is always what I'm trying for, is that you can invite a reader to identify very fully with your emotional experience of a given situation. In that case, I can invite a reader to identify really fully with the worry that I was feeling for my very young infant daughter, you know, all the, you know, going, taking her to the doctor over and over again to get more and more blood drawn from her tiny little arms, you know, taking meticulous notes on every single statistic about thyroids that the doctor says to me, because, you know, when I took very good notes in 10th grade, it meant I got a good score on the test. So maybe taking notes is going to help me and my daughter now, you know, that you can invite a reader very fully into your perspective, but then you can also kind of turn on yourself in a way and invite a reader to see everything that you had been blind to in a moment. And what I wanted to do in that moment was sort of bring a reader very deeply into my anxiety and into my worry, and then turn just for a moment to show the ways that my anxiety and my worry had made me blind to somebody else's pain, in this case, you know, my ex-husband's pain. And I think that that's kind of the way that one of the ways that first person narration, personal narration, can model a kind of ethical education, I guess. Like, what are those moments in life where when we're invited to get jolted outside of our own limited view and see what we haven't been willing or able to see? You can kind of ask a reader to go on that journey with you, even in a very small moment.
It's such a good answer, because there's no judgment of what happened in this moment. It was just your ability to recognize how he felt. Throughout the book also, we travel with you over time in this kind of internal journey, and we go back and forward. We go back to the subject of the previous book, The Recovering, for example. And you allude to it here. If my whole book, referencing it, if my whole book was a hymn to sobriety and sharpened attention and showing up and staying present, then why was I sitting here fantasizing about feeling whatever this hairstylist had been feeling when they made these luscious fabric flowers? This is when you were having a promotional photo shoot done in the sublet. Because, of course, Leslie, all this was happening when the huge success of that earlier book and the book tours were happening as well. Let's just add this into the complexity of life. But there's this kind of self-analysis that informs you, and then you share with the reader. Analysis is perhaps not the quite the right word, is it? It's an understanding more than analysis, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think it connects to what we were talking about earlier about complexity and trying to make every character that I write, myself included, a complex character. And when I started to write about my own life, I actually found that when I kind of created myself as a character on the page, and when I talk to my students about writing memoir, autobiography, or personal narrative, I really say that to them. I say you're creating yourself as a character, which is not to say that you're being false or writing things that didn't happen, but just that for a reader, they don't know you. They don't know anything about you. All they know is the character you've built for them on the page. So you're really building yourself from scratch. And I think that's a really kind of fascinating project, but a tough project. And when I first started to do that work, I found that my impulse, because I was so deadly afraid of self-aggrandizement and, ennobling myself and making myself look good, like these just seemed like nauseating prospects. So I think I did the opposite. I made myself sort of loathsome in a way. It was almost like I said the harshest, most self-deprecating things I could think of about myself on the page, partially because I was so afraid of doing the opposite, and partially almost in a way I wanted to judge myself in every possible way before a reader could judge me, to have every bad thought a reader could have about me before they could. And I realized, in time that that kind of self-judgment actually created just as flat a character on the page as, self ennobling self-aggrandizement. So I had to learn to kind of, as you said, present myself in all my complexity, like in my flaws, yes, but also to not take that kind of hyper focus on my flaws to such an extreme that I made myself sort of caricature or villain on the page. And yes, certainly one of the dilemmas in the book, or one of the things that I'm trying to write into the book into in the book is like what it means to be a mother. And a writer, what it means to be somebody who's working and caregiving, when those things feel in conflict, when those things can maybe even move together, when there are many ways in which mothering has also kind of informed my artwork. So I wanted to write, like, yes, that struggle to be a working mother and a working single mother, but also to really raise that question of like, how does witnessing your child and getting to kind of be present, getting this first row seat to the development of a human consciousness, how does that also, how has that shaped the art that I've made, which feels like something that I feel incredibly grateful for?
It's another reference for the word splinter, isn't it? The splintering of our lives. And this is recognised in so many people's lives between these different demands and never feeling like you're doing okay in any of them. But you said something important earlier, and it's to do with what memoir is, and almost a sense of a need to defend memoir. And yet some of our most beloved writers, you're thinking of the likes of the Didions or the Sontags or whomever, go right into that detail and right into that personal experience. And that is why we love memoir. and we can pick a fake one. You know, if you don't go there in its entirety, what's the point of it? But do you ever feel a time where you feel like you have to defend that now? Is it a genre where people seem to be losing the whole point of it?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think, you know, to your point about the way that you can feel a sort of falseness or a hollowness, maybe when somebody is telling a story about their own lives, but maybe you sense that they're not going to the deepest or most difficult or most truthful places. It makes me think about something that the American essayist Philip Lope likes to say. He's a colleague of mine at Columbia and a friend. He says, you know, the problem with most confessional writing is that it doesn't confess enough. And a lot of people would say, you know, the problem with confessional writing is that it confesses too much, that it like lays everything bare, that it holds nothing back. But I think his point is that the problem with personal writing that kind of doesn't confess enough is like, well, when you maybe describe the events of your experience, but you're not rigorous enough in seeking meaning in them. And I think that some of the shame that can attach to memoir, some of the, you know, to your question, some of the times or ways that I've felt the need to defend memoir, defend personal narrative, can come from a sense that, you know, it's assumed there can be a sort of solipsism or a sense of solipsism that can attach to the genre, that you somehow think your life is more important than other lives, or your life is more interesting than other lives, or your suffering is more acute than other people's suffering. And for me, none of those things are true. I don't write about my life because I think it's any more interesting than anybody else's. I write about it because it's the life that I've lived. It's the life that I have the most access to. It's the set of particulars that I can most readily draw on. It's my own consciousness is the consciousness I can kind of plumb most deeply and most fully. But I believe truly that like every life is full of profundity and interest and meaning. And I've certainly, I bring a deep curiosity to other people's lives. You know, I love memoir as a genre. I love reading memoir, but I also love talking to a stranger in an airport bar and hearing their life story and asking them questions. So I truly believe that every life is sort of as interesting and as illuminating as the questions you ask it. And so for me, there's not really hubris in the memoir genre. It's really just comes from a deep place of curiosity.
The discoveries along the way also are recognisable for people. You reflect on your childhood, you reflect on your relationship with your father. There are kind of aha moments as we go through this journey with you. There's the moment where you admit to yourself that you left the marriage, not because necessarily it would be better for your daughter, but because it was right for you. The aha moments, I'm not sure you can write them into a fiction character the way you can in memoir. And I think that's what people share with the memoirist. An essayist also, as we said, I think your first book was a novel. You recently wrote a piece about gaslighting for the New York Times, about the ubiquity of the term, and you put out the call and received a flood of responses. Why and how so, Leslie?
But I first of all, thank you for the question, because I do, you know, my own work takes a few different forms. I write fiction. My first book was a novel, but I also do write, I write criticism, I write art criticism, I write literary criticism, and I write journalism too. And this gaslighting piece for The New Yorker was really a journalistic piece. So I was engaging with a book by a philosopher that was a sort of an attempt to define gaslighting. I was also looking at the origins of the term. You know, it's become, you know, at least in America, you hear it all the time. You know, so-and-so is gaslighting me, Trump is gaslighting America, you know, everybody's sort of gaslighting everybody. But what does it mean? And, you know, the term actually goes back to this movie from the 1940s, originally based on a play from the 1930s about a man who's basically trying to steal his wife's jewels. And so every night he goes to the attic of their Victorian townhome and he's looking for these jewels in the attic. And because he's up in the attic, the gas lamps are flickering elsewhere in the house, and his wife sees them flickering and thinks, why are the gas lamps flickering? And he tells her, they're not, they're not flickering. You're imagining it. And that's obviously where the idea comes from, that somebody's telling you not only your version of reality is wrong, but you can't even trust yourself. You can't even trust your own perception. So, I started by saying, I want to hear some stories. I want to hear stories from people who have experienced gaslighting. And social media is like the end of the world in certain ways. It's bad for us in all kinds of ways, but it's a really good way to connect to other people's stories, a really good way to crowdsource often. So I got so many responses from people, many, many people who had experienced what they understood as gaslighting in a romantic relationship, but also people who had experienced gaslighting from coworkers, people who had experienced gaslighting from doctors, people who had experienced gaslighting from their families. I ended up talking to and writing about a woman who had suffered from a congenital form of hearing loss for her entire life, but had been told by her parents that the family doctor had found nothing wrong with her, when he actually had, because they didn't want the disability to make her feel weak or to doubt her own capacity. So she'd sort of lived with a sense that she couldn't even trust her own actual sensory experience of the world. So what I came to feel was that there are certainly very extreme, toxic, manipulative, damaging forms of gaslighting, but also that actually the uncomfortable truth is like a lot of us participate in gaslighting in more minor ways, probably more frequently than we'd like to admit.
Fascinating, Leslie. Thank you. I've run out of time to talk about you being a medical actor, which of course is part of the empathy exams. But there literally is a job where you act out symptoms so that medical students diagnose them. What a wonderful job for a writer.
I was always embellishing the backstories. That's the danger of bringing a writer to that job.
Thank you very much, and we look forward to your visit down under, Leslie Jamieson. She will be here for the Auckland Writers Festival. The details are on our website. The book we were discussing for the most part was her latest memoir, Splinters, Another Kind of Love Story.